meetings when it comes to public participation in the public safety forum meetings. Only certain people are invited by invitation, and I've raised this in the public safety forum meetings in many occasions to say that hand delivered invitations should be given in the post boxes in terms of this meeting, not on the radio. We have old people sitting in the houses that cannot even go to the library to go and read advertisements. So I'm saying that hand delivered, yes, it is a duty to hand deliver or to send out messengers to put notices in the post of those specific meetings. In those meetings, technical people come and speak to people who do not have much help, have the qualification. So our people are sitting there with a view that they do not understand a thing what is being explained in those meetings. Luckily for us, as an environmental group, we had a specific person speaking to ESCOM and pointing them out on a few wrong points. And I have evidence of the questions he has asked ESCOM. ESCOM has now put their lawyers onto this guy for asking questions in a public safety forum meeting. There are 12 important questions, and one of these questions might cover the issue of the cement structure covering the reactors. He's claiming that the steel inside of that cement structure, it could be rusted. Honorable Chair, so here are the questions. It is questions that he posed in a public safety forum meeting. And now ESCOM is saying that he's making accusations, and now they have put lawyers on him. Unfortunately, he cannot be here today, because he has to also go and see his attorneys to fight this thing. But here is the evidence of the 12 questions that he posed to ESCOM. Honorable Chair,
with your permission, can't you go through the screen and 12 questions? There can't be too many.
Unfortunately, I'm not qualified to understand all the writing on this. But he has left me his phone number, his details is on there, and that is the 12 questions. I mean,
your permission. The purpose of these questions being raised here is that as a parliamentary, as a member of parliament, then it absolves the person from prosecution because they are now parliamentary. Because otherwise they are private. That's why I'm at my right, they must be read here.
Okay.
The company,
on
so there's parliamentary protection, you see.
Okay, I will read it, honorable minister. Okay, Honorable Chair, I'll have to read these. there's very detailed things in here. One of the point number one, let me read it out. Let me not voice that. Does Cooper Union Power Station have the COC? I suppose that is the code of conduct. I don't. COC for complete electrical installation. Then it's got another abbreviation here, EIR, 2 and then whatever in brackets. Then what is the earth voltage at the power station? He's saying that ESCOM is running on a fault. Now, I've spoken in short sessions to him, but I do not have evidence of. He actually said that the committee can call him and he will come explain what he has said here. Then the third question is, how does it differ from the voltage between earth and the earthing system, i.e. is there an earth fault and what? And of what magnitude? How is it possible for an elevated voltage to have been presented for so long if the regulations specify the actions to be taken in such an instance? Does the plant have a Department of Labor appointed competent person or a GCC, GMR? Is the electrical machinery inspected as the EMR, type of subsections, whatever? Have the classifications of hazardous areas been done by AIAs, i.e. Techno Labs, which should be independent, stands ISO IEC 17020, which invalidates the classification. How effective is the cathodic protection in reference to the construction rod embedded in the concrete surrounding the reactor? That is the one question that I asked, because he has claimed that ESCOM is there for the past, since 19 whatever. He's claimed that this is right next to the sea, so that steel inside that construction is rusted. That is his claim. How is the hydrogen gas used for cooling the alternators is very explosive. why use this gas and not an inert gas such as nitrogen? The audit result of the last test of boric acid solution, the state of compliance with the added codes for hazardous locations, the test implementation, test and collaboration certificates. Honorable Chair, once you scratch the deep into certain things, I'm glad I'm putting things on record here, because I might not be here tomorrow or the day after. I mean, once you start scratching and going into these big industries, your life becomes entertained. It becomes shorter. You get into danger very soon. So, Honorable Chair, the community of Atlanta is appealing to whichever committee that they should not direct the further development of nuclear. They are also claiming that the radius in which this two new reactors, it will not even include Atlantis for public participation, so the radius will be smaller. Honorable Chair, I'm saying that the community of Atlantis, it is still up to them if they want such a facility next to Atlantis. You see, big industries are bringing dump sites and everything to Atlantis. Everything is just being dumped in Atlantis. There is no alleviation on job creation. I mean, if we're looking at renewables, and I've come along 7 or 8 years with Earthlife already. The first workshop that I attended with Earthlife, I was interested in what they were saying, and I'm still here today. So you see, we always, the environmental groups are always seen as a bunch of crazy monkeys. They are fighting a cause, but they are small drop in the bucket. They just fighting, but nothing will come from their fight. But I'm saying today that the community of Atlantis says no to nuclear power, and it is evident. We have our chairperson from the Public Safety Forum meeting, which we have elected, and the vice chairperson of the Public Safety Forum meeting, which is in the house today, and they are Clarence will be speaking on a few of the issues. I thank you, Comrade Honorable Chair.
Thanks. I hope I'm both a comrade, Chair. Not sure about that, but I hope so.
Absolutely.
Take questions on both the reps from Namaqualand as well as the rep from Earthlife. Mr. Morgan. And then Dr. Ngopa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To both Earthlife and the reps from Namaqualand, I'm interested in whether the representatives of the respective organizations are aware of any epidemiological studies that have been done in respect of one nuclear with regards to Kubrick, with regards to Atlantis, and Fall Pits with regards to Namaqualand. If it has, is it available, and are there any details around it? So it's with regards to, you know, the possible, with any studies done on the actual effects it's having on human health, particularly in young children, and then also in soft tissue cancers in elderly people. And is that, with regards to the gentleman from Atlantis, is that the issue of epidemiological studies, is that on the agenda of public, of your community forums that you have with the ESCOM representative at Coburg? Is that something that you demand? Is that something they offer? Is it even on the table? Thanks.
Just to respond from the side of Namaqualand.
We'll take a round to preserve time.
Okay.
We'll come back. We'll come to this. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I think the questions that you said that the person raised and is now being chased by ESCOM lawyers, I'm not very sure what exactly. Are you sure that he's really being charged, and if so, for what? Because the question that he raised, I do not see where they may be offensive. The last two questions about the rust, yeah, the rust of the reactor, they call it defense war, they call it a defense war, biological defense war. All nuclear power plants that are based on water, pressurized water reactor or light water reactor technology, they have to be next to a very big reservoir of water. And if there is no water, you can't eat there, it's put next to the sea. And so there's never been a problem. So I wouldn't know why they would want to, charge him for having raised that type of a question. So I'm not sure, really. I think you must check what he has been charged for, and if so, bring that to the commission, which we will study what he has been charged for by ESCOM.
Dr. Mkwen, we must thank the two communities of Namaqualand and Atlantis for taking the trouble to come here, because they justify our parliamentary oversight work. That's number one. Number two is I've been covered by the good doctor, Dr. Ngobo here, because he's an expert in that field, so people can feel relaxed. They'll be immune from prosecution because we'll defend them. Number three, on technical grounds. Yeah. Number three is what we said about the Perindaba people who took the trouble to come all the way and using their own resources. They shouldn't do that because they are helping with different democracy. They have also been the Atlantic and the Namaqualand people. The Namaqualand is not here, very, very far, almost next to the moon. They must also be assisted. And number four, I think what you should do is to pin down the officials who are coming up with this campaign of installing nuclear facilities from Nexa or Quebec, by wanting to install a nuclear facility in the Namaqualand and Atlantis, by merely calling a bluff. In fact, it's not calling a bluff, it's in terms of the procedure of the EIA. They must call a public meeting in the hall where we as a portfolio committee must also be there as witnesses to hear what the people are saying. Because this is what the Act says. It says, thou shalt call a public meeting so that the people can express their views. And to do it very professionally, you tell the community, when you come to such a meeting, please come with your views. Don't be more standards, come very easily. And there will be a register so there can be evidence that the people in the hall are not just a bunch of rebel rousers, but they are residents, bona fide residents of a particular place. And if they say, no, it's not. So the EIA access will be complete if you have credibility, and there's no way in which government can go against the will of the people. So, in short, it should be a well-organized meeting, not just a meeting under the tree of people who are just noisy and difficult, but the EIA officials must be invited to the meeting. And the next time people must also be there, you must say to the next time, please come and explain to the people why you want to put up this new facility. And they can come and explain themselves, and then the EIA, people must also be there, and we will be there as parliamentarians to witness that such a meeting. And then for the credibility of the meeting, you must have a register of attendance of everybody in that hall. And then there's no way in which government can move against the wish of the people, because it will be, everything will be open bar. So I'm just saying to the person, but the next exercise, nobody will be bulldozed to wake up one morning and find a nuclear power station under their nose without the community participation.
Okay, can we have some comments? I think I've noted all the members wanted to ask questions. Can we have some comments?
I just want to respond about the reports of any health audits ever being done. We've asked repeatedly that ESCOM do a health audit on the communities of Kamasi, Rooifontein, people who live in Gamup. That's never been done. And then these are very poor people. There isn't a doctor. If they get ill, they have to go to Springbok. And it's also the sort of situation that Josh Rappo's case, the people there will not complain to the employer if they get sick. Or they could very easily be intimidated, you know, with the threat of losing their jobs. The other problem that we have with these meetings, and I welcome the comments of the last couple of speakers about public hearings, they insist on having the meetings at Pumacate. Now, Pumacate is 64 kilometers from Springbok, and Pumacate is 100 kilometers from Springbok. So we have to travel 164 kilometers every time they have a meeting, and we've asked time without number, have the meeting in a central place like Springbok, so that more people can be informed about what is happening. So we'd like that message, if you people, the portfolio committee, can lean on them a bit, because we haven't been able to get them to have the meetings in a place that's more accessible.
Maybe before you, let me indulge this citizen.
Thanks, Comrade Chair. I just want to add on to what Comrade Terry has actually said on the matter of workers' health and community health in the Macmillan. I've been campaigning. My name is Mike Canty. I was campaigning in 82 onwards and also in the Macmillan in the 90s as well. What we found in a particular incident was that one of the casks that Falkwood fell and broke another cask and spilled the contents of the nuclear waste into the trench. Seven workers from the Namakolan community who were picked up on short-term contracts and put in that trench without benefit of blood or protective gear, nor facilities, nor any training, nor any advisement on the risks of working in that trench. Those seven names were submitted to me. Affidavits and ID numbers were given to me. This information was submitted with respect to Comrade to the National Nuclear Regulator. And we still have to hear the outcome of that submission. Thank you, Comrade.
Thank you about that, Mr. King.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just to ask your question, Honourable Member of Parliament. We're still in the beginning stages of the study, and I've taken the study that we're going to conduct is a occupational health study, and that will be on workers. But I said that since I've introduced the thing in Atlantis, that we're going to do the study, Earth and Africa, people have come forward from the community to claim that they have lost loved ones who worked at Eskom. So now, it wasn't presented to the committee, the Public Safety Forum Committee, as yet, because we are in the beginning stages, we are busy doing our homework. And there's things like cost studies that you must do. There's a doctor that must work out costs and things. As soon as those things are, we've even gone to the unions to go and ask the unions, what will it be possible to speak to Eskom workers? They have said that it's an issue of, does the worker want to speak to you? How many people will be prepared to do that? And how many people have signed contracts in the apartheid era saying that they are sworn to secrecy, that they cannot say what is happening on site? So, I mean, we faced with all that small issues that is actually stumbling blocks to gather this information to do the study. So yes, we are in the beginning stages, but we are not too far from starting the process. If Eskom will be transparent in any way or allow us to gather all this information, I mean, then we can kickstart this thing as soon as possible. The issue of has he been charged? I've just spoken to him an hour ago when I left the room. And he's been asking me, did you present my 12 questions to members of parliament? Honourable Chair, the questions he has raised is the questions he has asked in the public safety forum meeting. It is exactly the questions that is stated on the paper. Now, we've all been part of the meeting, myself, Clarence and Barbara, and that is exactly what he has asked. Now, he has been they stated that is allegations he's making. Now, according to me, the paper that I've seen and the email, the fact he has sent me, those are questions that he's asked. And he's got a right in the public safety forum meeting to ask his questions. Now, I'm saying that I will do my homework and I will present to this committee that, or I will ask this specific person to even come in to come and see members of parliament to say what is the allegations against him. But I'm saying that is what he has said. The 12 questions he has asked has now become allegations. Now, the minutes of the Public Safety Forum meeting, there's lots of flaws in that minutes. I mean, we are continuously struggling with things that we have said and it's not even militant. So, I don't know what does the minutes reflect because I have not received the minutes on the 12 questions he has asked. I don't know what the minutes are saying, but I believe that certain things that he has said will not reflect on those minutes. That is my belief because I've been coming with the Public Safety Forum meeting for quite some time and I've seen it. The issue of the rust, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of Parliament, if you put any piece of steel next to the sea for 20 years, you will find it rusted in 20 years. So anything contained in a cement, or anything contained in cement, will be rusted after 20 years. It's right next to the sea. And I mean, we've even seen the buildings in Cape Town with steel inside. There's lots of buildings standing around. If you see just a chip in the wall, that cement, the thing on the inside is rusted. I mean, it's something that we should look at. I mean, if one of those reactors goes tomorrow, that concrete, if we don't look into the matter, the question that is...
Sorry, Commissioner, I'm going to interrupt you there because we are standing here in solidarity. This is a global movement against nuclear energy. It's not just the man from Atlantis. It's also people of Namaqualand that are here. And there are people in the Navajo Nation banned the use of nuclear energy. For them, it's bad medicine. They say the stuff should never be taken out of the ground in the first place. And if we don't have any solidarity as citizens, as people, then we are nothing. Doesn't matter where we're from.
But,
can I just, because I'm sorry, can I complete what I said, Honourable Chair?
Can I know that these are emotive issues, but let's restrain ourselves. So, if you are speaking, and as I said, when I allowed someone or the gentleman here, I said I was indulging you, because we're not supposed to allow other people, otherwise it becomes an indiso. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between an indiso and the portfolio committee meeting. So I'm sorry, but this is how it's done. This is what we have accepted, Bangla, and this is what we have to our constitution. I don't want to break the constitution.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of Parliament, I must apologize for any inconvenience that we have caused you now. Honourable Chair, you see, there's so many loopholes that we're facing. I mean, even this lady of Atlantis that has lost her husband, she's facing the same situation that Amanda is facing that has lost her husband. No compensation was given to her. She's left with a house that belongs to the bank. She needs to pay that house. It's hectic in that house. I mean, since 2004, she's lost her husband. It's hectic where the husband was earning a salary, at least they could pay the bond and whatever. Even the Honourable Councillor Danbari, by soul rest in peace, was working at ESCOM. He is now, I believe, passed on. And even he had cancer. I mean, those are evident cases of people who work at ESCOM. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of Parliament, I thank you.
The committee wants to really listen and support the grievances of the civil society. But you see, if we do not guide you correctly, especially people like myself who understand some of these issues, that's where you become vulnerable, and even therefore your argument, which is very valid, becomes lost into the whole thing, because you become and view those kind of loopholes to suppress everything. And look, it's unfounded. This is why I asked one of those questions, what did the company charge him for? You see, because according to the question that you gave, we can't charge him. But But again, what the other presenter just said, which the other presenter was just said, you see, you can't also present this that the case of the distill of that distill if because it's next to the sea. Because all nuclear reactors of light water reactor technology type, which is type of movement, all of them that need water for cooling. They are built, their lifetime is 45 years. 45. They are built according to the lifetime and everything that they use, the steel that is used for the guarantee of the lifetime of 45 years. So all over the world, that's what it is. So now if you come with an argument like that in a court when the company comes, then like when you say, you see they are taking something which is totally unacceptable everywhere in the world. So it's better therefore to confine our argument to real issues that are not going to challenge you in terms of expertise in the technology, but in terms of things that really affect you where you are. So I think that's a very important thing that you must call again.
If I may, my name is Clarence Mentor. I'm the chairperson of this public safety information meeting, and I have the minutes of the last meeting, which I have not signed yet, so the meeting cannot go out to the public as yet. The question that was asked was the following. I would like to know what you are doing about the 50 volt elevated fault on the station. In terms of the electrical regulation, you should not be allowed to run. You should shut down. The answer that came from Ms. Karen de Villiers, who is the secretariat and also working for Eskom, was this. No one from Eskom was able to answer this question and could also not determine exactly what the issue was. Mr. Mark Meyer was requested to send in the exact questions. So then I suppose those were the questions that he sent in so that the relevant people at the station could answer the questions. These questions and answers would be included in the minutes, and if necessary, someone from the station would make a presentation at the next meeting on the issue. So I think Mr. Meyer is covered. He's got nothing to fear with. It's in the minutes. I will sign it as soon as possible, and it must go out for public information. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Comrade Chair. Can we now then move on to Maya Abderman and David Fink. Can someone help me? And at least after these two presenters, we'll take some health break.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. My name is Maya Everman. I work at EarthLife Africa Cape Town. I'm coordinator of the Nuclear Energy Cost the Earth campaign. I'm sure you can assume from that what we feel about nuclear energy. Our written submission covered a wide variety of areas related to our rationale behind our opposition to nuclear energy. I'm not going to go into detail on all of those. I think some have been sufficiently covered, and I will focus on particular areas. So our written submission, which also, let me just say, honourable members, is not an exhaustive, comprehensive list. There may be some that we have not mentioned, but The first is nuclear energy generation results in radiation harm to humans and the environment. I think we've heard about that today, and maybe we will still hear some more. That nuclear energy generation carries the risk of catastrophic nuclear accidents. That nuclear energy is not a viable response nor a solution to climate change. That I will be addressing in my presentation in more detail. And I would call your attention also to the submission of the Climate Action Network, which was a written submission that was made addressing this issue as well. The fact that nuclear energy results in highly toxic and harmful radioactive waste that cannot be safely disposed of, I think that has been addressed. That nuclear energy is uneconomic, we will hear a lot more about that, I imagine. That we are fast approaching uranium peak, we will hear about that. Better alternatives to nuclear energy are available, I think that has been covered by this morning's first presentation. That public input is lacking with respect to nuclear energy, and that nuclear energy in South Africa is plagued by many institutional problems. I think that has been alluded to already in many of the presentations, but I'm going to focus quite specifically on that and highlight some particular examples and institutions that we highlight in that respect. So I will continue now. I think that sometimes also when we have this, you know, anti-nuke, pro-nuke debate, we sometimes get lost a little bit in the details. So for us at EarthEye, as an environmental justice organization that has a focus on access to energy, sometimes it's necessary to step away and to look at, you know, the bigger picture or the frame, the context in which we fight, the struggles that we fight. And I think as parliamentarians, you certainly will identify with some of the priorities that are listed here. The fact that we need to meet energy needs, that energy drives growth and development at a basic cellular level upwards, you know, moving into the economy as well, that job creation is a priority, that we need to meet certain development goals in order to alleviate poverty. We also have the challenge of climate change, the fact that we need to protect our environment and promote clean energies, also that we need to make sure that our spending, our public spending is prudent and that it's done within the framework of good governance. So the first that I've said I will address is the fact that as far as we're concerned, EarthEye, nuclear energy is not a viable response nor a solution to climate change. Carbon dioxide is produced at every step in the nuclear fuel cycle. This diagram shows you a bit about the nuclear fuel chain, beginning on the top left-hand corner with the mining of uranium. In the past, it was mined largely as a byproduct of gold, but indications are that prospecting simply for the purpose of mining uranium is happening. There's then milling and the conversion or the enrichment of fuel, fuel fabrication in the reactor itself, and then the steps that follow that, which have got mainly to do with the storage of waste, different grades of waste, and then also, if that is to happen, fuel processing. Now, with the exception of the actual reactor itself, which it operates on a daily basis, all of those stages in the cycle produce carbon emissions. Uranium ore is not an efficient energy source unless the ore grade is high enough. The lower the ore grade becomes, the more energy is used in order to process the fuel, because most of the time uranium, as it's naturally extracted from the ground, is not what is used. It needs to be enriched and made into, and I'm not a scientist, so forgive me, perhaps Honorable Mr. Gobel can help me there, but my understanding is that then uranium is in its natural form is not the correct isotope that one uses to produce nuclear energy. It needs to be enriched as a process and so on. So the lower the grade of ore that uranium is extracted, the higher the amount of carbon dioxide is used in order to make that uranium into a form that can be used in the reactor. And obviously, if nuclear energy generation is to expand, demand for that uranium will increase, and we will need to use, by necessity, lower and lower grades of the ore. A study by the Oxford Research Group into the availability of uranium has indicated that at current, or at the generating capacity that we have had in the world in 2005, if we continue at that capacity, by about 2016, the ore grade will fall significantly from the average that we extract today, and even more so up to 2034. And then also, I think that this might be addressed later in the day, so I'm not going to focus on that too much, but there is evidence to suggest that we are fast approaching uranium peak, that the uranium that we are relying on to fuel this expansion of nuclear energy is actually a much more finite supply than we may have thought. I think that has been addressed. There was some issues also around the idea of fusion and so on, and fast breeder technology and reprocessing and so on, but I think that the commercial applications of those technologies will evade us. If one were to assume, which I think would be an incorrect assumption, that nuclear energy were an emissions-free energy source, which I think I've quite clearly showed it is not, nuclear energy still wouldn't offer the kind of hope as a response to climate change that we might be looking for. Climate change is a global problem. We in South Africa don't experience it alone. And if one looks at the global consumption of energy and electricity, electricity is just one of the human activities that produce emissions. There are others, transport, agriculture, deforestation, and so on. And in fact, the carbon dioxide that is released worldwide through electricity production is just 9% of the total annual human greenhouse gas emissions. When we produce electricity to provide heat, nuclear power loses its greenhouse gas emission advantage over two other technologies that are available to us, natural gas-fired cogeneration and biogas cogeneration. Recent research done in China and also in Germany has supported that conclusion. And then if one looks at the comparison between nuclear and renewables, nuclear power releases 3 to 4 times more carbon dioxide per unit of energy than renewables, if one takes account, as I said before, of the whole fuel cycle, which was presented in the diagram before. And then, obviously, the other issues around sustainability, the dangers of radiation, the lack of the solution to waste, low levels of job creation, etc., all those reasons also indicate that nuclear energy is not a viable solution to climate change. Further, nuclear energy is one of the most expensive ways that you could choose to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. Energy saving is clearly the cheapest option. Recent figures released by ESCOM have indicated that to save 1 megawatt is 10 times less expensive than to generate 1 megawatt. And I think we can conclude that perhaps not enough is being done in South Africa with respect to energy efficiency. Nuclear power is expensive electricity. The costs of nuclear power do not stop once the plant construction is complete. You've got the decommissioning, you've got the long-term problem of radioactive waste, and those problems add to the costs. Often, also, those costs are not included in the costing of nuclear energy, which is a big problem. I think we can conclude, as someone much brighter and wittier than me once said, that nuclear energy needs climate change more than climate change needs nuclear energy. Now I would like to address what I said, also alluded to earlier, the fact that nuclear energy in South Africa is plagued by many governance problems. ESCOM, as a state-owned enterprise, is responsible for almost all, I think it's, someone can correct me, but about 98% of the electricity that's generated and sold in South Africa. The South African government has a mandate to provide energy to meet the needs of the South African people, to fuel growth and development, job creation, those kinds of things that we spoke about before. I think, though, also we could agree that ESCOM is operating as a business for profit. You visit, as I did this morning before I came here, the ESCOM website, and you're trying to find what is usually the about page when one goes to visit an organization, and the first thing on there, what you would call about page, says business vision. It doesn't say government mandate. It doesn't say anything like that. It says business vision. I mean, I could go on about this for days. It's something I feel very passionately about. I won't, but I hope that you take that point, honorable members. And so for us at EarthLife, concerned with environmental justice, there is therefore an implicit conflict between providing the highest quality and affordable energy for the South African people and generating revenue for an enterprise, for a business. And that is highly problematic. Further, what we have, I don't think just here in South Africa, but other places as well, is the absence of full cost accounting or an integration of the externalities into energy pricing. What do I mean? You have a lot of costs that are externalized when calculating the cost of different energy choices or different energy options. These are things like the cost of the depletion of natural resources, pollution costs, health costs, which often are passed on to the health infrastructure of a country, which I think we can all agree we can hardly afford here in South Africa, the cost of regulatory control, the cost of waste management, and then also the cost of what are called opportunity costs, the cost of not pursuing other alternatives. And so what you'll find often with coal and nuclear energy is that those costs are not taken into account. They're not quantified and added to literally, you know, the operating and maintenance and fuel costs of any energy generation technology. And then in contrast, some of the benefits that one gets from other alternative technologies, like significant job creation, like energy security through decentralization, those costs are then not included further. So you have a disadvantage that we perceive alternative technologies are faced with in terms of full cost accounting. Again, something that I feel quite strongly about, the balance of power within and between different departments that are jointly responsible for energy governance is skewed in favor of corporations and profit. Sounds like quite a radical statement, but I think that some of the testimonies that we've heard today would support that. Further, I'm going to explain more so why we say that. And perhaps we are a little radical, but perhaps there's value in that, to balance what we are constantly propagandized with on a daily basis on the part of other corporations. I think the person who presented from D-Tier this morning indicated that better than I could ever have stated, when all the answers to his questions were, it's not our responsibility, it's not our responsibility, it's not our responsibility. And that is just simply unacceptable. Right, I think I've covered the first point there. The National Nuclear Regulator is situated within the Department of Minerals and Energy. The Department of Minerals and Energy has already indicated the fact that it is actively promoting nuclear energy. Furthermore, the Minister of the Department of Minerals and Energy is responsible for deciding which stakeholders should constitute the board of the National Nuclear Regulator, and is also responsible for appointing the individuals who sit on the board of the National Nuclear Regulator. So in that way, the Department of Minerals and Energy is playing both the coach and the referee in the match of energy choices, and in particularly in the match of regulating the nuclear industry, which is potentially a very dangerous and lethal industry. That is highly problematic. The National Nuclear Regulator, I think, even itself feels uncomfortable with that inherent conflict. They have alluded to that sort of informally in meetings with us, and I think that they seek, you know, to really have the power to implement their mandate, but they are being prevented from doing so. I think that we can congratulate them on their what we saw in the newspaper on Monday with regards to them halting any further processing of safety parts for the pebble bed modular reactor, because they had not been even consulted or involved in the process from the start. That is a practical reality that demonstrates this point better than I could do today. Furthermore, the National Nuclear Regulator has admitted to lacking capacity in several key areas. Firstly, they have admitted the fact that they cannot independently license the pebble bed modular reactor. They will have to recruit expertise from overseas. Not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that, but I think it highlights the fact of lacking capacity. Secondly, in meetings that we have had with them, they have indicated that they lack the capacity to independently evaluate medical reports that they receive from, for example, Nexa. So it becomes somewhat of a rubber stamping exercise. Nexa sends their reports. There's no one at the NMR who can say yay or nay, dispute or agree, and therefore nothing gets done about it. Furthermore, simply from a very logistical administrative perspective, just try to interact with the National Nuclear Regulator, whether it's by phone, whether it's by post. It's very difficult to get a response. Letters are not responded to. Even getting minutes for meetings becomes a long, exhaustive exercise. We're currently engaged in several prior applications to get minutes from the National Nuclear Regulator, which has dragged on for years. I've only been working here for 18 months, at EarthLife, I mean, and all of those applications predate me. Further, the issue of the revolving door between the nuclear industry and the National Nuclear Regulator, I mean, I think one can understand that, you know, nuclear expertise is often at a premium, and to a degree, you know, it's understand that people might, you know, move between. But as an example, the current chief executive officer of the National Nuclear Regulator, the last job that he had before his current job as CEO was as licensing officer for the Federal Modular Reactor Company. So he will be ultimately responsible for awarding the license to PBMR Pty Limited, and his previous job was as licensing officer of that company. That is seriously not okay. I mean, I can't use stronger language than that. I would swear, but I wouldn't want to in front of the honorable members. But I feel very, very strongly about this.
It would be unparliamentary.
It would be unparliamentary. Thank you, honorable chair. I don't know. I'm going to leave with the in and out issue there before I get too hot under the collar. NERSA, I think, is, and I haven't gone into as much, you know, depth in terms of my research as I have with the National Nuclear Regulator, but my understanding is that NERSA is faced by some of the same, you know, institutional problems in terms of the power that it has versus the industry that it's required to regulate and its capacity and so forth. We recently finally had a staff member from NERSA admit in a public forum that he found it amazing the amount of money that was spent on renewables versus nuclear energy. He admitted that nuclear energy has received upwards of 6 billion rand and counting versus 4.5 million that had been available for renewables. And I think the fact that he had to come to a public forum with those kinds of figures indicates perhaps the level of desperation that he may feel. I'm speculating, but I think I have that right. Further, there are some issues which also have been highlighted by some of the other comrades that presented today around the National Environmental Management Act, the proposed amendment, which will give the discretion to an individual minister to determine whether or not a development needs an environmental impact assessment. I mean, that the people shall govern, I don't know where that's disappeared to, but that proposed amendment to NEMA is abominable. Because the idea is that power should not be centralized, as far as I understand, and that people should participate in decision-making. That proposed amendment to NEMA erodes that 100%. Further, the similar kind, and I again don't know too much about this one, but in the Minerals and Petroleum Development Bill, they again are suggesting that applications for prospecting and mining rights may not need the kind of environmental impact assessment that one would desire, and that is again being proposed that be left at the discretion of the minister. Now again, I would highlight the fact that the Department of Minerals and Energy has an active, you know, interest in promoting these kinds of technologies, as they should. I mean, that is their mandate, but then one cannot leave those kinds of regulatory controls in the same hands. Also, I'd like to highlight some challenges around the fact that governance and decision-making are often non-transparent or accountable in this respect. I've spoken a bit about the prior applications that we have, the Promotion for Access to Information Act applications that we have, which have dated for very long periods of time. The Pebble Bed, I think in 2000, the South African government commissioned their feasibility study on the Pebble Bed modular reactor. They asked a number of international experts on various areas from economics to nuclear safety to look at the Pebble Bed and to establish its feasibility. That report was never made public. To this date, it remains unpublished. And I would ask the honorable members why that is so. I would speculate that it says some negative things about the Pebble Bed modular reactor, because if it said wonderful things, I'm sure that we all have heard it many, many times. In fact, we might all have been posted individual copies.
Sorry, Chairperson, this is very, very quick. Can the lady please repeat that?
Sure. I'm not sure about the year, but I believe it to be in 2000. The South African government commissioned a panel of international experts ranging from economics, nuclear safety, all the different aspects that one could consider in terms of doing a feasibility report, to look at PBMR and to do this feasibility report. Now, that report has never seen the public light. Yeah, it has never seen the light of day. Subsequently, the Legal Resources Center commissioned one of those experts, a man by the name of Steve Thomas, who works at the University of Greenwich in the United Kingdom, to look particularly at the economics of the table bed. That's his particular area of expertise. That's what he was doing in as part of this team of international experts. And his conclusions in the independent report are very, very damning about the economic impacts of the table bed modular reactor. Yes. He has made, I know, a submission which looks, I think, more generally at economics of nuclear energy, but definitely the particular study looking at PDMR and its economic feasibility is available to the honourable members. We would be happy to provide that. The ICAN, it's not nuclear related, but just to illustrate further transparency and accountability and where it's lacking, the South African government through ESCOM has signed an agreement to supply ICAN, an aluminium smelting company from Canada, with 1,300 megawatts of electricity, about half of what Saigon consumes, the whole of what Port Elizabeth consumes. It is expected, although we have been unable to get the figures from ICAN or ESCOM, that ICAN will pay approximately 18% of what Soweto residents pay for their electricity. This is at a time when we do not have electricity to meet all of the needs that our people have in South Africa. Furthermore, ICAN is a foreign-owned company. The majority of its product, aluminium, will be exported out of South Africa. The project will only create about 1,000 jobs. And in the past, ICAN in Canada bought subsidized electricity from the British Columbian government and then resold it at a profit to the citizens of Canada. Now, as I've said, our partners at EarthSat Africa in Johannesburg have been unable to access the information about that agreement from ICAN or from ESCOM. I would remind the honourable members also that this is taxpayers' money that we've been talking about because ESCOM is a state-owned enterprise. Furthermore, there's the absence of a policy framework and public participation with respect to nuclear energy. The White Paper on Energy 98 says, and I quote, "Government will ensure that decisions to construct new nuclear power stations are taken within the context of an integrated energy planning process with due consideration given to all relevant legislation and the process subject to structured participation and consultation with all stakeholders." I think we can quite conclude that neither of those two things have been done. Integrated energy planning has stalled, largely because they were supposed to do a study on externalities, which I alluded to earlier. That was supposed to be funded by the British High Commission. Some problem came through, and that study has not been done, and as a result, integrated energy planning has stalled. I mean, we're talking about a long stall here, not 6 months. And nuclear expansion plans have gone ahead. I mean, ESCOM has announced its intention, the government has announced its intention, but still we lack this integrated energy policy planning process, and we certainly, certainly lack structured participation and consultation with stakeholders. There's no policy. I mean, there's no policy that addresses do we or do we not go nuclear. And yet, we seem to be doing it. The Constitution provides the right for a healthy, safe, and clean environment and for the right to have information that can help us to achieve that healthy, safe, and clean environment. But I think we've all the presenters have indicated today that the vast majority of research and studies that have been done in this field have been done by independent individuals or organizations using very few resources. Mariette Liffring has demonstrated that. We ourselves, both with reports that we've commissioned on looking at renewable energies and also the health study that my colleague and comrade Mashile Palani has been working on, as well as that Keenan has been working on. Those are all, you know, independent studies. The study that was commissioned by Legal Resources Center from Steve Thomas about the economics of the Table Bed Modular Reactor and the work that is being done by Dominique from the Pelindaba Working Group. That is the body of information that we have available to us. And I think it's fine for the honorable members to interrogate that information. That is their right. That is their mandate. But at the same time, that is all that we have available to us because no one is doing epidemiological studies. Those studies cost a lot of money. They take a lot of time and expertise. No one is doing those kinds of studies except us. So I won't rant anymore. It's got to be, you know, productive. Yes, I can. I can rant for days about this issue. But I won't. Don't worry. Don't panic. And let's look at what can we do constructively? We need to realize the promises of the white paper. Integrated energy planning needs to happen. It must integrate the externalized costs and it must make decisions about the future nuclear direction of South Africa. And these processes must have facilitated, timeliest, informed, all-encompassing, structured public participation with all stakeholders. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Aberman. Without any further ado, I'll hand over to David.
Thanks, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I wanted to say that I endorse fully the previous presentation, and I won't be repeating much of the excellent information that was located in that presentation. I do, however, want to read a couple of things into the record, and my four major points really cover the economics of nuclear power, our jobs, our democracy, and our environment. And I hope you'll indulge me for a little while. We have heard today from a lot of environmentalists and a lot of communities, and I wanted to take the perspective of a business view. Not that I'm from that community, but I've been reading what the business community has to say about this industry. And
David, you don't have a slide presentation.
I do, but would you like?
Yeah.
It's longer than I'm going to talk for. So let me limit it to just what I wish to say. No. So I'm going to say less than was in my presentation because I think a lot of it has been covered.
Okay.
If that's all right. So what I discovered was information from the World Business Academy, and they have said the following. Nuclear power has failed to fulfill its potential in the marketplace. They said that during the 1974 to 82 nuclear reactor market crash, electricity companies cancelled orders for over 100 reactors, many of which were well under construction. Wall Street rated nuclear plants as high risk and turned off the money machine, and high risk was right. The Business Week in July 2006 last year said that the reason for that was that the nuclear industry had a history of construction delays, cost overruns, and bankruptcies. In addition, they quote Forbes magazine, which had a cover story called Nuclear Follies and showed the United States' experience with nuclear power, they said in their own words, was the largest managerial disaster in business history. And they added that only the blind or the biased can now think that their money has been well spent. So that's really all I want to put on the record on the economics, because Maya's done a very good job of looking at it locally. When we look at studies that show about job creation, we know that in the power shortages in the Western Cape in the end of 2005, it was clear from reports from the National Energy Regulator that Kubert had been mismanaged. The report's findings were based on information provided by Eskom, and that information, their report concluded that the major events that were investigated clearly indicated some deficiencies in the management systems and general ill-discipline in particular at Kuberg. This is from the National Energy Regulator's report. And I think the reason underlying that was the growing dissatisfaction of the reactor operators. Due to their dwindling numbers, the expectation is that they work longer hours, forego leave, and they may stand to lose benefits if they resign. And under such conditions, it is no wonder that there's demoralization, ill-discipline, and a failure to fill existing vacancies. This places us all at risk. At Kuberg. When we think about expanding the industry, and today's paper said that the government is now committing an amount of $400 billion to this industry. When we think of the expansion that involves, it can only occur if we train sufficient operators and engineers or our alternative is to import them at high cost. So we're not going into an industry that is involved in local job creation. Keeping them happy and content and happy in their jobs will cost us hugely. And if we contrast this with the research that's coming out on the potential of the renewable energy industry to provide jobs, we know that at least there's one report on the South African situation by Agama Consultants showing that we stand to create a great deal of extra jobs. Around 35,000 is their prediction within a short period of time, and with only limited investment in the renewable industry. And the beauty of these jobs is they're not just for a few people, for a few highly paid people. We can decentralize the jobs, place them in our communities, where for a small investment, we can train members of these communities to install and to maintain and to repair much simpler technology than nuclear technology. These jobs will be spread throughout the country, not confined just to a few nuclear sites. And the benefits will multiply, as you all know, honorable members, inside the community, bringing money into people's homes and bread on their tables. The nuclear option places us in the hands of a few highly paid operators who will cost enormous amounts to train or keep in their jobs. When we look at our democracy, what does this industry mean for our democracy? For a start, when you think about $400 billion we're spending on one subsection of our energy industry, when we're saying we can't pay our public servants what they are asking for, we really can't throw all our eggs into this basket when we haven't even got education, hospitals, police services that are happy, content within their work, doing a good job for all of us. We need to take that $400 billion very, very seriously. We also are saying that we are not being consulted. We've heard today about the promises, Trevor Mandel 94, the 1998 Energy Summit, Energy White Paper, which came out of the Energy Summit. That policy is still what we have as a policy. We haven't got another white paper. We don't seem to have any say until today when we're pleased and proud that we can engage with our decision makers about whether this technology is the most suitable one for our development needs. The technology seems to have been chosen by a few ministers without board consultation, and it is clear that the policy is coming from above. When I looked for records of it being debated within political parties, there were no such high-level debates. So it's not something which people have debated. And it needs to be opened up to all the stakeholders. We've heard all the evidence from different South African citizens that who are more than willing to come to the party and engage with our decision makers. Even with the EIA that we know about, the pebble bed, it was rejected because it didn't take public interest into account. And none of this is very surprising because the whole industry around the world, not just in South Africa, has had a history of secrecy and unaccountability. And here in South Africa, we're trying to build a democracy to nurture a culture of openness and transparency. However, it seems that everything to do with this industry and its policy making around the nuclear question is secretive and untransparent. The public, we've heard, is not allowed to have sight of minutes. We're not allowed to know the price of electricity that's being sold to Alcan, we've just heard. We're not allowed to, even the state has tried to stop us from hearing what is going on in trials of people who break the law and traffic illegally in nuclear material. So these are just a few examples. The failure to release the report on the pebble bed modular reactor that we heard from Maya. These are just a few examples. We can cite many. And of course, the industry can't be as open as it should be because nuclear materials, by going into that industry, you risk the nuclear material going into the wrong hands, and that is potentially disastrous. But we have options. The same cannot be said for the solar, the wind energy, and many other renewable energies. It's not leading us down that path which we've escaped from, of having the high security state we had during apartheid. We don't want such a state anymore. What we fought for was openness, democracy, and not that kind of industry that imposes a new security state on us. Just because of one technological choice. Just because of one technological choice. So, if we go down the road of expanding this industry, 400 billion rand budget, facilities all over the country, we face very serious risks. One is that our decision makers are going to start to think that enrichment is something we need again. We closed that down when apartheid ended. Why did we do that? Because the apartheid state used that to manufacture nuclear weapons. Today those weapons are called weapons of mass destruction. They were made close to the Atteridgeville community outside Pretoria. Do we want that situation to be a possibility again? I don't feel we do. And yet our Minister for Mineral and Energy Affairs is starting to open that door again and say we need local enrichment. And so the industry is pushing us in a direction that we don't necessarily want our country to go in. This is over and above all the environmental problems which different people have raised, the health problems, the problems for community health. One of the honourable members asked, is there any study on epidemiology? In other words, the effects of radiation going into communities. And when we met some time ago, October 2005, with the National Nuclear Regulator, they said, no. Our methodology is not to look at the impact on communities. Our methodology for looking and tracing the radiation is just measuring what comes out of the nuclear facility, not what goes into the next door community. So the very methodology, the scientific methodology of the NNR, following the world trends, it's not that it's unusual, should be looked at. Do we want them to stop at the point where they measure just what comes out of the plant? Or do we want them to take some responsibility, and if they can't, someone else should, of measuring what goes into human beings that live on the periphery of those facilities? And if we don't do it now, and we give the industry 400 billion rand to play with, then it's going to affect many, many more people. We won't just have representatives from three or four communities making these submissions. We will have the whole country, anyone living near to these plants will be potential victims. We have the potential, if we give the industry 400 billion, they've got to move the materials around the country. They've got to import some of the stuff. They've got to move some of the waste around the country to where the facilities are for waste disposal. They will be moving it on our roads. We know that we have one of the highest accident rates in the whole world on our roads. We have spillages every day. The other day we had a spillage of, I understand it was frozen fish on our roads. We would welcome that one day, as opposed to the potential harm that could be done if nuclear materials enter our environment through that. We have huge waste management problems. You've heard about even the facilities at Falpitz, the leakages of drums where the NNR had to close down Falpitz for some time. Radiation Hill inside the Pelindaba complex. The workers who have to deal with these materials. We haven't tightened up our conditions under which they do this work. We haven't got support for them when things go wrong, and they're facing the compensation commissioner is not processing their applications fast enough. So there are all sorts of things that we have. And I just want to say that the industry is selling itself on the basis of the position that it takes on its contribution to preventing carbon emissions. And you heard from Maya that's simply not the case. You have to take the whole picture from cradle to grave and look at the entire picture and not accept that semi-truth that we're going to end up with a society that has to manage all these problems. We are saying that there's still regulatory problems in our society that we have to iron out before we can comfortably say our regulators are empowered, they're equipped, we trust them to do a good job. these issues are too large to be rushed through, and it's important that honourable members of the Portfolio Committee question the executive thoroughly on these matters, ensure that due procedure is followed, scrupulously in terms especially of the EIAs, and especially in the public participation that you've all been discussing. And we also need the fiscal vigilance to safeguard against going over the heads of the people to commit and committing the country to falling into the trap of believing that this industry is clean and green and so on. Far from it, as we have heard today. The industry has no compunction in placing us all at risk, and we have to ask who is profiting from this and who stands to profit when things go wrong. So finally, we want to pay tribute to this parliament and previous parliaments after 94 for placing the precautionary principle in NEMA. Our legislature did not place it there for nothing. Let us honour their foresight by honouring the principle. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Fick, for a very comprehensive and illuminating presentation. I'll now hand over to members to ask questions. Robert Gwen?
I could ask little no questions, but it will be defeating the purpose. I was a bit ambivalent. But let me go back to the ambivalence and come back to the side. Allow me this ambivalence. I want to play devil's advocate. If we close our eyes and imagine South Africa without Eskom. That's one scenario. Then we open our eyes and we close them again and imagine South Africa with Eskom into the future. How far are we going to go on this roller coaster? And then we open our eyes again, and then we have another scenario where we say, let's throw everything away, chemical energy, and just go renewable energy, one way. Would we be able to cope? I'm just asking. That was a question. But I want to come up with, it appears like a facetious scenario. But in order to try to teach the process what, I want to suggest to a person that what I think we should do now is to adopt the strategy of the Freedom Charter. Professor Zach K. Matthews, who's the motivator of the Freedom Charter, was the Secretary of the Nation in Cape Town here. And they went to Bloemfontein and said, look, the whole world knows what is wrong with apartheid. But we have not written down the alternative. Right. And then they went to Bloemfontein and proposed, we, the Western Cape region of the ANC, are proposing that we should come up with a document that doesn't just complain, but that says how they get out of the rut. What was? And of course, then the rest is history now. I'm not an exponent of film chat, I'm just reminding us of it. Now, how would it be, Chairperson? We as the Portfolio Committee of Environment Affairs and Tourism, under you and also under Dr. Nobo here, who is the Chairperson of Science and Technology, and of course we put in the MSA, Nati Mteta of TME, we co-sponsor a conference, not a talk show, but a conference where all the lobbyists, let's use practitioner language, and I want to be pejorative to be, because lobbies who are anti-nuclear, deliver themselves initially, or then put it positively. Anybody who's got progressive ideas about renewable energy and efficient energy, all those people who are protagonists, not necessarily anti-nuclear, but you see, guys, we know the dangers of this, my group here said, the Frankenstein, the nuke, for instance. Anybody who has got something progressive, alternative, come together now with a business plan and budgets. Not just to come and talk again. Yeah. Right. Come up with a business plan and say, we who are in the Ayolena wind sector, we want to have these turbines, we have so many, and they'll power so much, et cetera, et cetera. And then those that are environment, et cetera, you know, different fields. Come up with all those things, put them forward, and say, it's going to cost us so much. So that we can then go to government and say, government, you know, you'll find this video, my friend, is going to be 2 months to tell us that you know, because at the moment the government knows, because they're questions that say, hey, the alternative renewable energy resources are good, but we don't have a coherent budget as to exactly how much it's going to cost us. So that we begin to force government that the Minister of National, the Minister of Finance yesterday, can begin to say, apart from giving everyone money, we want then, just as we've experimented with the PDNR, giving the money, we also have an obligation to give the renewable energy protagonists some money so they can begin to start their renewable energy experiment in the same manner as we're experimenting about other things. So we need to have that national budget of renewable energy. And that shouldn't be a partisan thing of 5-10 people under a tree in Joburg or Cape Town or whatever, but then a national conference. So now when the intention goes, people must go there now and, you know, with a string of hammers and say, hey, you guys back, no, that we haven't. Want people to come up and say that now we are in this sector of renewable energy, this is what we can do and this is how much it's going to cost, you know. And then get economic experts and say, the purpose is to present a budget to government, a national budget of renewable energy.
Well, that's an interesting suggestion. Certainly we'll have to look at it. I don't think that the portfolio committee is equipped to respond to your question now. We'll note it. We'll come back to the record of Parliament. Manzanga?
Chairperson, thank you very much. Chair, through you, the young lady mentioned something about what the people of Soweto pay for electricity. I did not hear it properly. I would like to know, because I'm from Soweto, and I would like to know how much she knows about what we pay in Soweto. Chairperson, the Rio summit of 92, at that summit it was agreed that environmental injustices and environmental problems and environmental injustices are linked. And when the economy of a country is weak, the people become very poor. Now, I'm speaking in terms of our people in rural areas who have no electricity. They get to cutting of trees so that they can survive, they can make fire, they can survive with whatever heating they can find. But what I would like to know is, we are all looking forward to having clean energy. But we have just had a presentation now, which seems to be only criticizing our government on a lot of things. And but I've heard nothing that tells us that here's the alternative. We can use this rather than what we need clean electricity, which will be clean as clean electricity, because we all need clean electricity. What I would like to tell you, Chairperson, is that once in rural areas, once an area has got electricity, all the other people in other areas who are still in the dark, once they move to a place where there's electricity and water, and as a result, the community, it becomes overcrowded in that area. They leave the places where they were, and they come and stay where they can find electricity and water. Now, for how long are we going to take Chairperson with when people who have been enjoying privileges in the past are telling us about what they think and when we know that our government is trying their best to give us electricity in rural areas, they don't come with an alternative, but they are busy slashing the government. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, Mr. Morgan?
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I don't really have any particular question on it. I thought between the two presenters it was exceptionally thorough, so I understand your views. I'd be interested, considering that Earthlife has been involved in court action on EIA processes surrounding PBMR, just your view on the following matter. I've noticed, and the reason I ask this is because I agree nuclear can be very, very secretive, especially the PBMR in South Africa. So even being a member of parliament, I don't necessarily have this information at my own fingertips. So I'd be interested in your view on the funding matter. It seems to me that up until some time beginning last year, PBMR, PTY, LTD was very much in the news. They were pushing their programs still. They came to parliament frequently. Almost by, whether by choice or by design, we don't hear much about the PBMR at the moment. But of course we now hear about a 400 billion rand nuclear build, which will focus probably on pressurized water reactors. Because, of course, you have been involved in various studies around PBMR, I'd be interested in your opinion on on the relationship, why the sudden rush on PWRs. And then secondly, your opinion on the following. Do you get a sense that from an NGO point of view, from civil society point of view, that energy planning, which stalled in the late 90s, and the lack thereof, and has subsequently created an energy crunch, going forward, is being used by the government to justify a nuclear build, in the sense that almost the problem was created and then the solution flows out of that, which is a nuclear build.
I'd like to ask some few questions as well. One, there's this, last week, or 2 weeks back, ESCOM mentioned about 2 billion investment in renewables. I'd like to hear your views on that. I hope that you were following that. What's your take on that? Then, is that too little, too late, or is it an initial good step in the right direction? What's your take on that? And then secondly, I'd like to also get some briefing on the difference. I think you mentioned this, Ms. Appelman, but maybe you can say more on the percentage difference of emission between nuclear-based energy systems and the others. What would you say is the percentage difference in emission? You also mentioned the issue of energy saving. Which is the leading country in the world on this? If it's such an admirable way of addressing the energy supply, where can we go and learn about this? Fourthly, the question of this, for some time, almost for about a period of about 20-25 years, there was no real mention of nuclear power. There was real decline almost everywhere in the world about it, but in the recent years, it re-emerged again. What explains this? What, in your view, is behind this recent rise in the currency of nuclear power as a source of power worldwide? Both of you could share in some of these questions. Thank you. Comrade Nobo, the last one.
Comrade Mwabon.
Thank you, Jack. I would like to thank the speaker. What he has presented is very sound. I haven't read some of the documents which he was talking about, and I would recommend that those documents about the economy of nuclear power and all those related things, and the members get hold of those documents, because they are very informative for people to argue from an informed position. I think that if you communicate with the chair, he can then distribute them to all members. You asked me sometimes about the origins of the fuel cycle. Yeah, indeed, it starts as a yellow cake. Uranium, uranium 3, oxygen 8, U308. That's a yellow cake. That's how it is mined. And then reprocessed to uranium dioxide and uranium hexafluoride. And then that's when they choose these compounds then for nuclear power generation. Then I always want to everybody to be careful, because that's why some of the very constructive debates get lost when you then meet experts. You see, I did point it out before that to say just squarely or generalize nuclear energy is a bit dangerous, because it is actually nuclear energy from fission power that has got the problem that you're talking about. And at the era where now there is a likelihood as they are going to put in place that fusion power reactor in Switzerland, we want to see that, because the exponential that it has got no radiation effects whatsoever up in there. So I would want us to be careful to talk about nuclear energy based on fission, which has got all the harmful and consequences, even in nuclear accidents like Chernobyl. The other type of reactor based on fission technology have shown that they will not even have any accident, even if there is anything. So I think, therefore, we must be careful when we discuss this thing, because probably we are not experts, but we are very moved about what has happened in places like Chernobyl, so that our constructive debate is not lost as just an emotional debate. You said something that you do not think that nuclear power is going to, has got anything to do with climate change. I do partly agree with you. It's very legal effect. In many centuries, the change from fossil to nuclear power may have some significant savings, but I don't think it will have significant unless it can be started so that the air is cleaned and everything is cleaned and then start afresh from the clean water. So I don't think that, in fact, I can tell you that the climate change and it is a program that came with the United States. There was a lot of it was the United States said it has nothing to do with nuclear reactor. When it came with the Generation 4 initiative, then it said, now nuclear power with small reactors, several times, all that, then everybody again back into the nuclear. I can give you a variety of literature on that. But we were just driven by one economy. We don't look into our real individual needs. Here in South Africa, we are the fifth largest exporter of third class coal, which is very useful for the generation of power. If we exclude the what they call the consequences of climate change, so. Nuclear power in South Africa didn't come as an alternative for energy. It came for nuclear weapons. And it only produces 13% of South Africa's energy needs. Because it was for the nuclear weapons program. The public thing. So I'm trying to say that. So really the stress that we have to have nuclear power, I'm not against nuclear power because it's clean. Well, I guess if you have expertise to manage it. But the problem is that it is not really something that I think we are running short of in terms of our energy needs. We've got a lot of alternative energy sources here in South Africa. There are 7 ways of producing energy, which we have here in South Africa. So I was trying to say that the mandates between NNR and DIT, they talk about narrow mandates. How far have we interacted with them? Because each time if we talk to NNR, they say they have just a narrow mandate of nuclear safety. And today you had DIT said they've got very narrow mandate. They've only been looking where these things, the environment is damaged, and nothing else. It's other departments. So how do you then work with a situation like that? Finally, I think the proposal from a member that we need to really brainstorm the energy policy. It's very important. We don't have an energy policy, and we don't have a nuclear energy policy. What we have is just a haphazard, but we do need to have a very thorough national workshop policy on nuclear of the country. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm partly covered. In fact, I'm almost covered by Honorable Ngob. But I would like to check with you if you do have these documents on email so that it's easy to send them through to the office of the chair. And on a simpler and lighter note, you seem to be doing such a wonderful work. Who is sponsoring, who is funding you to do so much? Thank you.
You respond. This question of nuclear, Dr. Field, should not even be considered as an element of our energy mix. We don't want it at all. Can you be on the spot and answer us on that question?
Personally, I feel that it's the wrong direction for us to be going in. I feel we already have problems created by the industry that we need to clean up. And that should be our focus. I don't think it, for the reasons I gave and for the reasons that you saw today, much of the evidence shows that if Dr. Ngobo is right and that we have 5 or 7 alternatives, why are we throwing priority money at this particular one technology when we could be exploring a number of other technologies? So personally, I feel this is not the suitable way for a country like ourselves to go. We have development priorities that it won't meet very easily. It won't meet people in rural areas for the simple reason that it is so expensive. If we adopt this technology, we're going to pay even more than we do at the moment for our electricity. Not companies like Alcan, which will do special deals with Eskom, but our rural people will not be able to afford it. Not only our rural people, but rates would go up tremendously for all of us. We will go into debt to pay back this $400 billion. It could bankrupt us as a country. Do we want to go down that road where we will be in debt for that money or taxed very heavily or our rates for electricity payment steeply rise because of this one technological choice? So I would say, Mr. Chair, we have to really reconsider the direction we are going in. And I feel it's correct to question our leaders if they make wrong decisions. And I feel we can do it in the name of the people that you heard today and the concerns that we all express. People with direct experience of the industry. People from rural areas. And I think they have important voices that are just not being heard. So that's why I am making my submission in the way I've done so. We also are leaving ourselves open to an industry that has to be untransparent. It has to be. It has to secure itself against the possibility of both people taking the material and using it for their own ends. As we've seen, there has been nuclear trafficking in this country by ex-members of the military program, people who were making the bombs. now have nothing to do. Now, what we didn't do was integrate all those engineers, all those people with nuclear skills into a new kind of South Africa, into a new kind of program where we could use their scientific and skills for social benefits rather than for them having to do this for private gain. So I think that when we were asked, should ESCOM exist or should it not exist, I think it should exist. It should act in the public interest, the broad public interest. It should be responsive to public disquiet when it's considering very controversial technologies. We should have a mechanism which we don't have in South Africa, which would go across all technologies, not just nuclear, that evaluates those technologies for our needs as a country with a lot of rural poverty and urban poverty. Is this the most suitable technology that we want to introduce? Whether it's agricultural, whether it's energy related, whether it's biofuels, etc., etc. We do not have such an office in this country, and perhaps one of the things we could ask the Portfolio Committee to look into is, could Parliament play a role? In other countries, there are parliamentary offices for technological assessments before which this would come and where the public would have a chance to raise its issues and the decision makers would then be able to take it forward.
So, just with your permission, Shepard, that's exactly the point I was trying to make. When I seen that the three chapters put for a commitment, somebody must give the initiative. And because he got to smuggle another point, Chairperson, we see how we lost ESCOM to Mittal Steel, to Mittal. Now, before we know it, we shall have lost ESCOM. Because it will be taken over by other people of the world and electricity will be very unaffordable. And we must not make another mistake of losing. But if we go on this roller coaster, we're going to lose ESCOM. Through the PBML, PBML is supposed to be a little baby, but it's going to govern the current ESCOM. Before we know it, because of the debt, we are going to spend billions to fund this bottomless pit, and before we know it, that's exactly what happened with ESCOM. Incidentally, we don't know. Because the directors of ESCOM will see ourselves and they will say, how can we market steel globally? And somebody says, well, this is Mr. Mitchell. He is a champion globally. He called the guy, he made a very impressive presentation and said, I can market you guys. Internationally. But they didn't tie him down to a price. He went and got all these deals all over the world. He came back and said, pay me. And they said they couldn't pay him, just pay him in shares. And that's how he took over ESCOM. So that's what is going to happen. I mean, the sophisticated board of directors is a big meeting with several CAs and all the politicians they have. Women, environment, youth, everything. They took a stupid decision. And that's because they said, they just let things just. That's why I say we need nothing short of this national contract I'm talking of renewable energy. Because if the other one is already running too fast, but you need to have come up with an alternative and speak in one coherent voice.
Okay, might as you come through, I would like also to, you see, you've got to ask all these questions. They are sometimes unfashionable, but that's our role, to ask awkward questions from everyone. The Alcan pricing. Surely people who are defending Alcan will say that even though they're making the concession with regard to energy price, which they'll say will have it in abundance, they'll say that we can do that because we get foreign exchange. How plausible is that argument? Can come on it as well.
Can I say about Alcan? Okay. Foreign exchange is not going to be a big part of it because we do not have the raw material that is being processed. The aluminium is not a mineral that we are rich in. So we are allowing a company to come in. They're not buying the mineral from us. They're bringing it in themselves. They're making a deal with ESCOM for cheap electricity, and as you heard, cheaper than householders pay, we suspect, because it's not yet public. But it's likely that that enticed them into the deal. It's a deal that then they export at least 75% of their aluminium to the outside world. So at the most, we can tax them on a quarter of what they're producing, not 100% of what they're producing. So it's not a deal that to me will bring in a lot of foreign exchange. It'll leave us, I mean, I think that you only have to ask the community at Richards Bay where there's two such smelters in rural areas, or it's slightly urban now, but two such smelters, what the health profile of that community is now. How many jobs are there for them? Very few. Very few. It's a very high-tech industry. So, we didn't do the sums. We didn't say, is this a deal that we want? Is it a deal that's going to help us? No, it's a deal that will help us export our electricity when we're saying there's a time where we're short and we're running short and we need what we have. So it's giving a foreign company electricity the size of the consumption of the Nelson Mandela Metropole. That's how much electricity they're going to get cheap from us, even when we don't have enough. So I find the deal very problematic, to be honest.
Sorry, yeah, I've been asked to make this chair whilst the chair is going on. You can give your feedback.
Thanks. I've taken copious notes, so I hope I can respond to all the questions. I think Dave did cover this idea of SA, you know, with Eskom, without Eskom, but for me, I think that it's important to step back and to ask sort of what is our vision for South Africa, what it is that we want to achieve, and then how can we do that? Because I think that, I mean, I was born in 82, so I'm still young, and I was not, you know, participating in the struggle, but from my mother, I've heard so much about this new world, this new South Africa that we were going to create and how we could create it. And it seems that the question has shifted from that to can we create it? But the point is that for me is not the question we should be asking ourselves. We have to establish the fact that we must. It is imperative to create a different world. And then not can we, but how are we going to? So it seems to me like we hold with a gun to our head, well, we must have this, you know, this, and therefore we must go nuclear. And it shouldn't be that, because I think that the renewables and energy efficiency and other alternatives afford us the opportunity to choose a different developmental path than other countries have done before us. And there's no need, there's no reason that we can't do that. I mean, we have such opportunities here in South Africa. We have so much energy that the world is watching us and is supporting us to create a different reality. And I really, really think, maybe naively, but quite passionately, that we can do that. And so I would look to say, what do we want? We want jobs, we want, you know, public health and so on. And how are we going to do that? Not can we. Do our people need to go a dirty, you know, unsafe, expensive nuclear route? No, we can be creative, we can come up with alternatives. If we spend the same amount of money and energy that has been spent pursuing coal and nuclear, pursuing alternatives, I really think we can do it. Anyway, enough with that. To address the idea of the conference, I would say that a fantastic example has been set in the Western Cape province by the Minister Essop for the Department of Environmental Affairs and Development Planning, which, what can I say, is a great department because it combines those two. I mean, that's a great example. And she has just held this Renewable Energy and Climate Change Conference in Cape Town at the Cape Town Convention Center, and there was a focus on one of the days on renewables. What are the challenges? What are the barriers? What do we need to do, you know, institutionally and logistically to support the development of that kind of an industry? And I think that kind of a initiative on a national level could be amazing. What I said in relation to Soweto residents, honourable member, was that the price, it's believed that the price that ICANN, this company, will pay for electricity will be only 18% of what the residents in Soweto are paying. So this company will pay only what, one-fifth of what Soweto residents are paying for their electricity. I don't know the actual amount. Electricity is not really my focus area, and, you know, nuclear energy is more. But I think also what's important to understand is that that is not an isolated incident. That is a trend. In South Africa, households are consuming under 20% of the electricity and energy that we produce. Yet they are paying the highest unit price. Industry is consuming 30% of what we produce and is paying the lowest price. And then transport is also consuming a lot, and I think we can conclude that our transport system needs a lot of work as well. So there is a trend that households and individuals, often poor people in particular, are paying the highest per unit price for their energy and electricity in comparison to big business corporations and transport. Just have a look here. PBR in the media and so on, there's a lot of theories. You know, maybe the fact is that finally people are realizing that PBMR it's a white elephant. You know, there's just nothing right with the project. Economically, from a jobs perspective, environmentally, in terms of, you know, foreign investors and the honorable member did allude to the fact that there are some agreements that have been signed, but my understanding is not that. My understanding is that the agreement between Westinghouse and other investors was for the initial phase of research into the project, and that agreement has lapsed, resulting in 100% shareholding being held by Eskom, as in the South African government, as in you and me, and so on.
Sorry,
what agreement is happening? What is happening? Now, understanding, this is also covered in Steve Thomas' report, is that there was an agreement between some different investors and PBMR PTR Limited, which is Eskom government, etc., whoever, you know, the South African players are, the Industrial Development Corporation, so on. There was an agreement for the initial, I suppose one could call it, research phase of the project. But that has not come to much, and that agreement had a sort of a cut of time, and as a result, that agreement has lapsed. So the 100% shareholding in PBMR PTY Limited has reverted to Eskom because that agreement has lapsed, because there's not been any move forward on the project. I mean, the economics of PBMR are like, I mean, read Steve Thomas' report, that's all I can say. You will, I mean, yeah, I don't even have words. It's just madness, frankly. I don't want to answer on the renewables because I don't have a high level expertise in that area, and I think that the alternatives were well iterated this morning by the presentation from Sustainable Energy Africa, and I would urge, as the other members have suggested, to focus, you know, maybe in a hearing on renewables, as in this type of conference that you've mentioned. I certainly will circulate the documents that were requested, in fact everything that's at my disposal, to the chair. Shame, I think his email is going to get quite blocked, but if you would like me to, that's not a problem for me at all. Thanks for the tutorial on uranium, it's appreciated. I'm concerned about this fusion versus fission, because I know that the public relations machine of the nuclear industry is super powerful, and yet, to my knowledge, I haven't heard much about this new fusion plant, and I believe that if it were as wonderful as it sounds, perhaps we might have heard a lot more about it. No disrespect to the honorable member, but I know that when they find something that they like and they believe to be working, they go all out to make sure that everybody knows about it. And then,
The chairperson has come, so I'm handing it over.
Yeah, there's something that's really interesting now, and that I'd like Mike to repeat just so quickly about the lapsing of the PBM contract, because I want to say something quickly for 5 seconds, just for his benefit.
Okay, the honourable member just asked about, I was referring to the fact that I don't think that the PBMR project does have the investors that I think one of the honourable members mentioned it having. My understanding was that there was an agreement between the different investors originally in the project and PBMR PTY Limited for the initial, I think, research phase. This is all in Steve Thomas's report as well. And that agreement had a cut-off time, and that cut-off time has come, and so that agreement has lapsed, and the 100% stake or shareholder in PBMRP2 Limited has reverted to Eskom. So currently Eskom is the sole shareholder in PBMRP2 Limited.
I want to latch onto that quickly separately, because I want to...
No, I don't think, I think it's IDC now. It's IDC has taken off.
Either way, I mean, that's also a state-owned entity.
Now, just one second. The point of why I'm interested, because now, PBMR came to the Petroleum Commission to make a presentation that PBMR is so successful, a company that they have actually employed 50 PhDs. They are boasting that they employed 50 PhDs, that's how this is going to fly. And I myself, the man who designed the spacecraft to the moon, Dr. Van Braun, was only one PhD. And the thing led it. They need 50 PhDs. Now, if they are so confident about the PBMR, why do they have to employ 50 PhDs?
Listen, I haven't spoken much today because I've been in and out the whole time. I just wanted to take on the PBMR issue with regards to, because there seems to be a lot of confusion about who actually has the shareholders in PBMR. I asked a question about 2 years ago about the $500 million that we were paying, that the South African taxpayer was putting into PBMR, and what that was going to fund. What it was told to me then was that was used to buy out the shares of Eskom, because they didn't want PBMR to be owned by Eskom because it was going to be a client of PBMR. So I don't know if something has changed in terms of that. But I think that this issue is very important as well in terms of governance, because what I'm interested in is who does the PBMR company have to financially report to in terms of Parliament, because we are putting a lot of taxpayers' money towards this, but yet it doesn't come to SCOPA. I mean, not that I'm aware of, and I've asked the chairperson, but it is a public entity and is being funded by the taxpayer, and we should call for them to actually come and be financially accountable to some entity within Parliament. And I think it is an issue to be looked into.
I just want to make some clarification to what she asked. Can I chat to you? Yeah. Oh.
Sure. There was a question around the mandate between the National Nuclear Regulator and the narrow mandate. I think it was Honourable Member. We did raise this in our submission to the Pebble Bed Modular Reactor Environmental Impact Assessment, the fact that, you know, this one's responsible for that and that one's responsible for this, but how can we be sure that there's integration, and as a result, how can we be sure that there's safety? And that environmental impact assessment has also stalled, and, you know, we're waiting for the next step. There was also a question around our funding. Earthmaps Africa, as an environmental justice organization, it's a membership organization that does receive funding for certain campaigns or activities. The campaign that I would be referring to would be the Nuclear Energy Costs the Earth campaign. And we currently receive funding from two foundations. One is the German Foundation, the Heinrich Boll System, and the other is the Wallace Global Fund. Both those are foundations that are interested in promoting participation of the citizenry in decision-making and environmental governance. I think, yeah, broadly, that would be, you know, what those foundations stand for, and they fund us.
Richard Whedon from African Health and Development Organization. I will be presenting a little bit later, but I thought maybe the question was asked earlier about, among other things, why the sudden surge of nuclear? And I think it's a really important one. I'd maybe prefer not to cover it in my presentation, but maybe quickly here. I don't know if everybody noticed, just over 2 weeks ago, there was a very big news item just before the G8 summit that Vladimir Putin threatened to point nuclear missiles at Western European cities. Because of the U.S. is wanting to put up a defense shield within Europe, it created a big stir. In fact, it took over most of the G8 summit. This is something that is closely linked. The Honorable Member of Parliament mentioned South Africa's original link between our nuclear weapons program and Coburg. This is pretty standard. As a matter of interest, we are my organization, among other things, there's a news analysis organization, and we've been covering news on environment, health, politics, economics for a very long time. Every single push for nuclear weapons is preceded by a push for nuclear power, usually within under a year. In fact, we laugh at it in the office. We just wait for it to come. Mikhail Gorbachev warned less than a year ago about the research in the Cold War, basically, and the push for nuclear weapons. He was the guy that was running the Soviet Union when Chernobyl blew up. He has a large amount of experience in dealing with the issues of covert nuclear programs, its link to nuclear power, and all the results of it. He warned about this happening. It is coming to the fore. A few months ago, Tony Blair was pushing for a resurgence of the Trident missile program. Months after, he was pushing for a surge of new nuclear technology in England against the wishes of the people. George Bush has called for a resurgence of the nuclear weapons program within the United States. And as we can see, everybody is linking very closely Iran, North Korea. There isn't much question about it. Some have suggested that behind the scenes, South Africa may have some other ideas about all of this. I think there was an article in the Sunday Times a few months ago about some scientists calling for a resurgence in South Africa's nuclear weapons program. It's a very disturbing article to read, but it's clear the two are closely linked. There is a well-known thing in the PR industry. If you have a lot of problems with something, the tobacco industry, the nuclear weapons industry, various ones, and you get blocked because of various things or an event, you wait 25 years and then you bring it back. It's well known. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks, Comrade Chair. I think this is an excellent debate because it touches on not only the nuclear industry issue, but also the nuclear weapons industry. And in fact, Foreign Affairs should be here right now to hear this debate. I think that what we're looking at, Comrade Chair, is nothing else but nuclear proliferation issues. When we say nuclear proliferation, we don't have to make the distinction between weapons and civilian programs. All we have to say is the term nuclear proliferation. I was privileged to host seven members of the Hiroshima city people a couple of years back, including a survivor of Hiroshima, who was a child at the time of the 1945 weapon attack. And I think that it is clear to the Japanese, at least, that there is a resurgence in the nuclear weapons industry worldwide. The question is, how do you support a nuclear weapons industry without nuclear enrichment? And how do you support nuclear enrichment without a booming bubble in uranium mining, allied to gold mining? So clearly, as one of five suppliers, I did some research in the uranium industry worldwide for Greenpeace some years back, how do you support a uranium bubble without a nuclear industry? So therefore, it follows logically, as night follows day, if you take Richard 25 years after Chernobyl, and you have a conference, a worldwide conference in a university in the United States, where Pebble Bed is represented by KDAX of the PEPCO. And this same fellow is found in a cabinet meeting, a closed cabinet meeting, a year later. One starts to put pieces together in this international puzzle, which are, I would classify them as epic commentary, worthy of a long narrative of Homer's, because clearly there is a cabal, a military-industrial cabal globally, including the G8 countries, Putin being notable exception, actually having his back against the wall, to be precise, who are collaborating actively, that's Canada, the United States, Japan, France, England, and strangely enough, not Germany, who seem to be the lone wolf in this matter, and largely because of their own internal political pressures against nuclear proliferation. So we have, a conspiracy theory notwithstanding, that something is going on. And I think that we as South African citizens who are veterans of struggle, especially myself as a veteran of the anti-nuclear struggle, I see the same old bells ringing as I saw in 1986. I see the same old voices being heard in the same old language and the same old tune, and I see even the same old faces. And I wonder to myself, has the South African government, can I be specific comment here, has the South African cabinet be by certain powerfully spoken individuals into accepting a technology which A, we can't afford, B, is not going to deliver electricity to the poor, and C, is in fact a mask for an agenda that's been set by certain, shall I say, northern hemisphere countries. Are we suffering from that shift from neocolonialism? That is the question.
Something much more?
Mr. Chair, I've been scratching through looking. Amongst the submissions that we were given, there were two, well, more than two, but there were two pro-nuclear ones. One's from John Ledger and the other one's from Patrick Moore, who was one of the Greenpeace guys. And I just wonder what is going on when you talk about the international scenario and a sort of resurgence almost of what has been called as the Frankenstein monster. France, for instance, is going along and is so committed to it that there's no way back. I mean, they're saying what is said here, Patrick Morse, John Leder, the World Nuclear Association lists some 440 new nuclear power plants in operation worldwide. 24 more are under destruction, 113 additional ones under consideration. France has 77% of its electricity from nuclear power. Sweden and Switzerland follow with 44 and 39%. And yet David is saying that there's a disenchantment with the going nuclear, and that there's a story of failures and liquidations, etc. What is the real picture? What does it really look like?
Thank you, Comrade Chair, for the indulgence. I think that it's clear, Comrade Judy, that this is something which has been thought through very carefully in the United States, to be precise. It is a legacy of the elder Bush's policies. And if you recall the axis of evil at that time, it was Iraq, North Korea, and Libya. Now, of course, these things shift. But clearly, the Rumsfeld-Cheney-Bush alliance, to be absolutely precise, comment, you're not to give any doubt as to what I'm talking about. That particular triple alliance has in fact orchestrated this particular shift in international nuclear policy to the degree that they've put all the weight of the MIT, for example, which is very much behind this. What I found particularly disturbing, however, is that when this decision was taken at a conference in 2001 in the United States, it was followed within 3 months of the resolution being taken at that conference, which I have privileged to again in the minutes, that all of the major magazines, including Science, Nature, Forbes, the MIT's own mouthpiece, every single journal within 3 months was carrying a cover page story on the resurgence of the nuclear industry, which was no such thing. So clearly, it's all done with mirrors. I mean, if you say 77% in France, they used to have 75% at the time of Chernobyl. So 2% is hardly a massive increase year on year. So, you know, especially in, what is it now, 21-odd years. So clearly what we're living at is a really well-orchestrated PR campaign. The fact that KDAC can fly out here and address Cabinet for me is highly significant. How did you get access to Cabinet? I'd love to get access to Cabinet. You know, it would be really a real privilege. So it seems to me if an ordinary corporate American can walk into a Cabinet meeting and address Cabinet members, something is rotten in the state of Denmark, come right here.
We'll see. Maybe we'll give you some time later on. Let's move on to the other presentation. Thank you very much, Dr. Fake. The other person is next is Angela Andrews.
Chair, can you excuse my members of my committee and my colleagues who are going to a meeting now at somewhere?
Okay, no problem. Again, I think I should take this opportunity to thank the colleague from Science and Technology for being here with us. We tried to invite other committees as well, public enterprises. I think they were here, and DME.